You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. You also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
The actual president of the United States there, urging everyone to try to see things from the neo-Nazis' point of view. My guests, Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including North Korea calms down just in time for South Korea and the United States to undertake military exercises. But is something really a provocation if it's advertised in advance? The UK's government suggests some ideas for dealing with the conundrum posed by the post-Brexit border with Ireland, and Australia's foreign minister reveals the full, hideous treachery of New Zealand's plot against her homeland. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Guardian and The Independent, and Robert Fox, defence editor of The Evening Standard. Welcome both. We will start in the United States, where President Donald Trump's talent for discovering new levels beneath rock bottom continues to astonish. At a bizarre press conference yesterday in Trump Tower, America and the world was treated to the spectacle of a US president equivocating about a torch-bearing mob chanting explicitly racist and or anti-Semitic slogans, demonstrating in support of a statue of a literal turncoat who led an army in defense of slavery and killing someone in the process. Mary, even by Trump's remarkable standards, it was a remarkable performance. Did it really tell us anything about him we didn't already know?
Well, I think it showed his capacity for going all guns blazing into a situation he should never, ever have got himself into. Because in a way, it was so easy, or it would have been so easy, to get this one right.
Condemning Nazis is pretty basic stuff.
Exactly. And, you know, all he had to do really was that. He could have gone on from there to attack the violence on both sides. He could have said there was good on bad on both sides. But that was the one thing that he had to do.
Well, the weird thing was he did get to that point. He made a bizarre, rambling, equivocal response quite early on, and then he made, or rather read out, an absolutely more orthodox and, you know, really quite correct damning of the neo-Nazis, and then he reverted to this.
Yes, which was extraordinary because the press conference, which wasn't at the White House, so he didn't sort of have to look particularly presidential, it was at Trump Tower, of all places, and it was supposed to be on the great plans for infrastructure development, which was one of his campaign pitches. But of course, you get a crowd of journalists together, and the one topic that everybody wanted to ask about was that, and it just seemed to me that, you know, watching it, it was just completely extraordinary because what you'd got was a president of the United States, you know, chief commander-in-chief of the American Armed Forces, leader of the free world, whatever you like to call him. I mean, he was just completely off script, and you just don't see that. I mean, it was a combination of shocking on the one hand and hugely entertaining, I have to admit, on the other.
Well, this is Trump's one unarguable talent for creating a spectacle, for making everything about him, which was obviously reasonably inconsequential when he was a self-promoting tycoon and game show host. He doesn't appear at all, Robert, to understand, and even if he does understand, doesn't care, that matters rather more when you occupy the office that he does.
I think that's the most interesting point about this. I take exactly what Mary is saying, and I think it was the performance. And I think if you looked at John Kelly's face, they were quite clearly worried that here was somebody who was going completely out of control. And I think that that is now a real worry. This is a man. It isn't that he was enraged. He wasn't relaxed. He had allegedly been on holiday. And when he starts shouting liars at the press and rambling, that was the other thing that really caught everybody. And the thing is that the metaphor is really the wolves getting closer and closer to the sledge. He has had the core constituency of the flyover states and the Tea Party, but there are more and more of the Republican movement coming out and absolutely prepared to state their principles and live by them. Just heard that the two presidents, Bush,
indeed,
have come out with a very firm statement against extremism. But I also think that this business council, well, we had a resignation from it. We've had a load more resignations. Now, this is going to be bad news, really bad news, very, very soon. And the thing that is matching this is his so spectacular lack of achievement in office. The things that he was supposed to have done. Yes, he talks about the fence and the Mexicans building him, but his failure over a thing that the misnomer is Obamacare, but the Affordable Care Act, which on the whole most people seem to want. This is a zombie presidency, and zombie presidencies look very dangerous in things like North Korea, which we're going to come on to discuss. And I am just looking at the fed up factor, and I see that in the body language of quite a number of significant members of his staff. The two Marine generals, very important that they're Marine generals, brothers in arms formerly, Mattis and Kelly, they look stolid. They make very little reference to Trump. They're trying to keep the show on the road.
Mary, Robert there mentions the fed up factor, and there have been some Republican voices making condemnations of his behaviour in, you know, variously explicit degrees. As he said, there's been a statement in the last few minutes from both presidents, George Bush, not mentioning Trump by name, I suspect quite properly, but, you know, rejecting racial bigotry, anti-Semitism and hatred in all forms. We've also seen more explicit criticism from the likes of Senators Rubio, McCain, former senator and presidential candidate Mitt Romney, and the resignations from his council of CEOs. Isn't the problem, though, that however much he annoys the Republican establishment is not his base? His base is not people who care one way or the other about the Republican Party, as indeed he clearly doesn't himself.
No, absolutely. And, of course, one of the reasons maybe why he was giving the sort of statements that he was that his base were among the people who were involved in the protests and the demonstrations down in Charlottesville. But I think there is... When does a time come when this administration or any administration becomes unable to function completely? Because I think I'm right in saying that there's still an awful lot of really not even just second order jobs which are unfilled. And this is going to make it extraordinary. If you've got people leaving at the pace that they're leaving, it's going to be very difficult to attract enough people to make to put the show properly on the road. And that, I think, is going to be maybe an enduring weakness. Who, after all, is going to join an administration which behaves like this?
Robert, you mentioned the former Marine generals, Kelly and Mattis. A development which struck me as quite startling in the last 12 hours or so, we've seen at least four currently serving U.S. service chiefs, generals from the Army, the Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Air Force, going on Twitter, obviously not mentioning the Commander-in-Chief by name, but making explicit statements against racism, extremism, and bigotry. Now, these are not stupid men. They know the context in which they're making these remarks. They know that everybody knows the context in which they're making these remarks. These are serving generals, four stars on each shoulder, distancing themselves from the Commander-in-Chief.
Yes, and I think that this is very, very carefully orchestrated. Colleagues whom I greatly respect, and I won't name them because it's invidious, but in my business, you know, commentators, defence correspondents, really very, very experienced people indeed, were much more worried about getting to the brink over North Korea. And because of the very factor that you have mentioned, I think cut to the chase, if Trump as the Commander-in-Chief gave a perfectly mad order, they wouldn't do it. And can I come back to the US?
Well, we've seen a precedent of that. He gave that mad order about transgender soldiers, about which the defense chiefs have done nothing.
Yeah. Well, exactly so. And I think it would happen operationally in the field. It is very interesting, though, that Joseph Dunford, who's the man in charge, in the most senior man in uniform, is also a US Marine. They are very, very tough, and they're almost a political arm. They do have their own politics. I'm not joking here, discreetly. And I notice in what Mattis and, of course, a man who's not a Marine, but H.R. McMaster, former Lieutenant General, they are very, very important figures in this, because H.R. is one of the most conscientious men I've ever met in public life, and they are just going to make it work. And what do we hear over the weekend? That Steve Bannon and the others are saying that he's too much of a good thing, and there's a toe-to-toe there. But the core, as I understand it, as reported from the Washington media, is that the core of the White House staff are behind McMaster and are fed up with the shenanigans that are coming from the shock jock world.
I think there's something to add here, too, that in the first few months, there was a degree of concern expressed, especially from abroad, about the number of military men, ex-military yep. people, that Trump was surrounding himself with. And maybe now we should be looking at them and saying, thank goodness.
Well, can I just add a very quick there? I mean, it is the thing that sort of crossed my mind, because I did come across David Petraeus, who was a very political animal, and he's in the background for obvious reasons, and he really did look papabile. I mean, he looked to me as being a soldier who would go for a military career. I don't think it's beyond a wit or imagination that any of the people, the kind of people, I don't think HR, but I think the other three, probably we might see one of them emerging as a compromise candidate for the mainstream Republican movement when they get so completely fed up with Trump's populism.
Well, let's move along now, but sticking seamlessly with the subject of slightly impulsive demagogues with strange hair surrounded at all times by generals, to North Korea, which in the last 24 hours does seem to have wound in its neck somewhat. This may change, however. Not only has Donald Trump gloated about Pyongyang's tactical retreat, but the United States is shortly to embark on the latest iteration of Ulchi Freedom Guardian, one of two annual joint military exercises that the US conducts in cahoots with South Korea and other regional allies. Mary, there has been some concern expressed that this may be seen by North Korea as a provocation, but it happens every year. It's advertised in advance. It has its own website. It can't really be called a provocation, can it?
It's always treated as a provocation by North Korea, every single time. And the closer the latest American bombers and stealth machines and everything get to the North-South Korean border, the more North Korea cries foul, and the more paranoid its statements, and the more it puts things on alert. It's always a very, very dangerous time. And very often, I think it's been actually quite badly reported outside the region, because often it's reported as though the paranoid statements from North Korea have come out of nowhere, whereas actually they've been responses to this particular exercise. I think in some ways we should obviously all be grateful that Kim Jong-un has appeared to back down at least a bit in advance of the timetable for this exercise. But I would also hope, if you can't actually count on it, that either this exercise would be postponed for some a pretext would be found to postpone it, or it would have its air exercises and its sea exercises much further from North Korean space than it has done in the past, that there would be a signal that would be quite clear and interpretable, even by North Korea at its most paranoid, to say this is just an exercise, it's not going to turn into anything else.
Robert, what do you make of North Korea deciding that it's not, on mature reflection, going to start launching missiles in Guam's general vicinity?
Well, I think it's a stunning diplomatic victory for Kim Jong-un, because he has made his counterparty, I wrote this in my paper, look the looser cannon of the two. Kim Jong-un has made himself look serious compared with Trump's antics, and that is really quite something. But it's not tit for tat. I am not just a sort of military tit for tat. I discern, I think, if they do it well, and it must be taken away miles away from Trump himself on this, with an astute operator, it's an opening for real diplomacy. And if the diplomacy really is real, sorry to go on about it, it should be pretty quiet. And the sort of deal that's been muttered around in by the commentariat for some time now is discussing the ceasefire, really getting a treaty, and really getting America and its client in South Korea to say we have no aspirations for the reunification of the Korean Peninsula on our terms. In other words, taking over the North. If that could be worked, they might be able to get to a process and say, and by the way, while we're about it, because we're all in favor of a non-nuclear world, we will discuss denuclearizing the region. But that cannot be done by America alone. It will need China. And China, as the silent party, it will have to be very, very important. But going back to the exercise, I absolutely agree with every word that Mary said about this exercise. If they must make it look routine, non-provocative, and that's where really interesting and important partners like Japan, Australia, New Zealand must come in and restrain the United States military, not only rhetoric, but posturing. That's the thing that's so silly. One good sign, again, is that they've stopped the wretched B-1Bs, I think, for over the last few days. They're not flying over the zone, in other words, the Korean Peninsula. And that, at least, is a good sign. But again, yes, Tillerson comes into it, but it's Tillerson, Mattis, McMaster and Kelly as the chief of staff. They've really... This is where it could go terribly wrong. There was a very good piece by Professor Neil Ferguson, a really exceptionally good piece, saying, you know, you do get funny tipping points in diplomacy. And he was quoting a great work on, you know, 10 points that have changed the world. And it is very good to compare this to the Cuban Missile Crisis, because... just think how the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy's time on Kennedy's watch, could have gone wrong. And with, on the point of delicacy, the pirouetting, we are in exactly the same situation here, I think.
I think it was also hugely interesting that when the rhetoric was at its most irresponsible and at its height between North Korea and the White House, what you then had was what seemed to me a rather judicious leak to say that actually there was a back channel already in existence and that there were discussions going on, okay, at a much more junior level at the United Nations, which of course is exactly the place where these sort of discussions ought to be going on. And so I think that in a way that was a signal sent out. Yeah. And you can look at the words that were being exchanged between Pyongyang and Washington, and you can say in some ways that may have been, as it were, overcompensation for what was known to be going on in New York.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Mary Dujewski and Robert Fox. Coming up next, Britain's government addresses another item on the long list of things they probably should have thought about before the Brexit vote.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dujewski and Robert Fox. It has taken a while, but the Brexiteer wing of the government of the United Kingdom appears to be absorbing the fact that actually leaving the European Union, as opposed to posturing about doing so in search of easy applause, is going to be difficult, tedious and expensive. Nowhere more so than along the frontier between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which in the event of Brexit will become a land border between the EU and the non-EU, and therefore a monster disastrous political headache. A new position paper details the government's proposals. Mary, is everything now just sorted out? It's all going to be fine, isn't it?
Well, what appears to be happening is that on the one hand, the position paper almost doesn't want to recognise the magnitude of the problems and thinks that it's all soluble with a combination of sort of turning a blind eye to small and medium-sized business on the grounds that the sort of trade that goes across the border won't actually really, not really, be international trade. And everything else will rely on high-tech and computers and all the things that Britain has proved itself so good at over the years.
Yeah, those big budget IT infrastructure projects, they always go absolutely seamlessly, exactly, on time, under budget. Can the common travel area as it now is, which they're insisting will be maintained, can it really realistically be maintained, though?
Well, the argument for saying it can be maintained is that it predates the Irish Republic joining the European Union, and it predates the Good Friday Agreement and the sort of settlement on Ireland. I think it's very, very doubtful that it can be maintained because it stands against everything that the European Union, a new consciousness of the need for secure borders, a new, as it seems to me, solidarity among the rest of the European Union in the light of Brexit. And I actually don't see it as realistic.
Robert, how important are the optics of whatever arrangement is finally established going to be? People will be very, very anxious to avoid things like flags, uniforms, sentry posts, watchtowers, barbed wire. It's tricky, this.
You were talking about how difficult and so on, your litany of epithets about the whole process. You didn't mention lengthy. This is going to go on for a decade at least. I'm familiar with that border. I think Mary must be. I've worked across that border. Very, very difficult it is, and there are a lot of tensions.
I've gone for agreeable country walks across that border.
But there are a lot of ethnographic, and not to say sheer criminal problems too, which people have been raising. But can I go on a point that you have just raised?
Please.
I think there is a huge problem with the Great Repeal Bill and Act, and I was discussing this, and I will drop a name. He's a very good friend. I was talking to Lord Peter Hennessy, the constitutionalist, and he is very, very good on this. And he said he is absolutely terrified by the implications of this, because it imagines by repealing, this is David Davis, Liam Fox particularly, you are going back to an Arcadia that existed in the United Kingdom around 1973. We can't, because devolution.
A year not as fondly remembered in Northern Ireland.
No, exactly. And devolution has evolved so much that if you try to do this, this is Peter's argument, and I follow it, that you are probably inviting the atomization of the United Kingdom, probably anyway, unless you do something very, very smart, because so much more powers exist in Cardiff, Belfast, and particularly Edinburgh since 1973. And the idea, where I think that Mrs. May has shown her wonderful tin ear yet again, just saying, I hear you, but I don't, I haven't got my ear trumpet, to people like Nicola Sturgeon and the Welsh leadership, it just won't wash. There is another thing that worries me enormously as a Brit, as a passionate amateur historian as well as a hag, is that the idea that the populists like Farage, the Boris Johnson, saying the people have spoken on a 2.5% margin, and nothing can be, as if nothing can be amended or modified by the practices and the levers of the Constitution. I think we're actually headed for a very, very serious crash by the time we come to the next general election, because either you're going to empower Parliament, which was a lot of the separatist argument, we come back and return sovereign powers, or you try and ignore them by some weird vision of the popular will. We are absolutely in uncharted territory for the UK. Probably nowhere where we've been since those absolutely radical arguments were fought over in very bloody fashion, I may say, in the 17th century in the Civil War.
I'd like to go back to what Robert was talking about, atomization, because I think that, I mean, I absolutely agree with that, but I also think that with Ireland, it is so dangerous.
Yes.
And the problem is that actually out there, beyond the British horizon, there is an obvious solution to this, which is already being reopened, which is the question of a united Ireland. Mm. And if you look at it, if you take away, which you, of course you can't take away, the special history of Northern Ireland, then this is an absolute obvious solution. United Ireland with proper sea borders with the with Europe. And the problem is that while this has been broached very, very tentatively at this very early stage in Dublin, while trying to pretend that actually it's not, then the trouble is it's absolute red rag to Belfast and to London.
OK, well, finally tonight, no Australian who has spent more than 30 seconds in the company of one of their cousins from across the Tasman at any point since 1981 needs reminding that New Zealand is yet to entirely forgive us for Trevor Chappell's underarm delivery to Brian McKechnie that time. Few of my country folk suspected, however, that the Kiwis have spent the decade since that infamy plotting revenge by subverting our political process with a cunning programme of awarding dual citizenship to people who might become Deputy Prime Minister one day. Precisely this scenario, however, has been sketched, if not indeed revealed, by Australia's excitable Foreign Minister Julie Bishop. Robert, first of all, calling on your military expertise, should Australia strike now before New Zealand rearms?
Yes, I think they're certainly striking in rhetoric, and I am fascinated by this because I find Australia, curiously, and I have to confess sort of part-time, I am a commissioner of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, the Australian participation, and I know it's your mother country, Andrew, I'm sorry to say, have a militaristic chauvinism, which is which is two or three generations behind almost all the other members, including, above all, the Indian subcontinent, in which they're all well represented, and above all, the New Zealand. But man for man, blood for blood, and sacrifice, of course, as we know, the New Zealanders suffered an awful lot more. Now, as a Brit, with many Australian friends in New Zealand...
I reckon we can take them.
Oh, you can? Well, what about the All Blacks, though?
Well, yeah, but that's rugby union.
And they're very good at special forces.
Which isn't a proper code of football, rugby union, so it doesn't count.
Yeah, but you'd have to take your Air Force off the board, well, because they haven't got their own.
That's their problem, not ours. Mary, the backdrop to this, of course, is the dual citizenship saga currently consuming Australian politics. I think we're now up to two resigned senators, a couple more mounting court action. I mean, there is a certain bathos to quite a lot of this. One of the senators who's had to quit discovering he was in fact Italian, a country he'd never even visited, never mind realising he was a citizen of. Julie Bishop alleges that the New Zealand Labour Party, currently in opposition, had some sort of role in flagging up Barnaby Joyce's Kiwi citizenship. Even if you think this is likely, which I for one don't, so what? He is in breach of the rules, isn't it? Does it matter how we found out?
Well, I suppose, you know, if you see plots everywhere and anywhere, and this is germane, yes, I'm afraid it does matter.
And if you have a narrow margin.
They haven't, the
present government of Australia has an extremely narrow margin. But Mary, Julie Bishop says this puts at risk the relationship between the Australian government and the New Zealand government.
Oh, good heavens.
Well, I mean, when you look at it from the opposite side of the world, I mean, we never actually dreamt, I think most of us, that there was any problem there. I mean, almost, they sort of perish the thought, they almost merge together.
Careful.
But I also think that it's also sort of poetic in a way. That, you know, where is Trump on the right issue when you need him? This is the guy who pioneered the birth of controversy.
Well, indeed.
Where do they need him? In Australia.
Robert, do we think bloodshed can be averted here?
I think so. I have a proposal, listeners. Don't you agree?
It better be a quick one.
I think you go in as our peace envoy. Typecast for it, Andrew.
That hopeful note brings us to the end of today's show. Mary Dijewski and Robert Fox, thanks for joining us. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Audrey Fyodorenko and Isabel Rosen. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.